You're listening to Money Never Sleeps Radio. In your face.
What we got here is a failure to communicate.
Oh, have I got your attention now?
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
You know what I mean?
Money to be made in a place like this.
Money never sleeps, pal.
You're crazy. Don't run when you lose. Don't whine when it hurts.
You know what it takes to sell real estate?
It takes brass.
I'm falling, and I can't get up.
All right, welcome to Money Never Sleeps. This is a show where we talk about anything and everything that impacts the flow of money from around the corner to around the world. And today we are going to talk about something pretty interesting that I really want to focus on, and that is on nanocap and microcap markets and the issues that they will be facing in the near future. Well, you have some that are facing it now. All right, the NASDAQ, they have increasingly shifted their focus towards fundamental sustainability rather than short-term market optics. And that is going to be a big deal because they're reinforcing their listing standards through rules such as NASDAQ listing rule 5550A2. That basically says that you need to have a minimum bid price of a dollar. You drop below a dollar, you're considered a penny stock. You do that after a certain amount of consecutive days, you have a window to comply or get downlisted. You have also another part of that rule, which is, 5550B1. A lot of numbers, a lot of letters here. That covers the minimum stockholders' equity of $2.5 million, but I think it's going to be $5 million or $10 million, something in that range. The bottom line is, these rules are going into effect to prevent the the murkiness when it comes to certain in the microcap market. You have some companies, you have shells that are on there, you have foreign companies that are on there, and I think the NASDAQ, what they're looking to do, and the New York is doing this with the American too, they're looking to clean house. They're looking to get rid of, the companies that really bring no value, that are potential, they could be potential vehicles for defrauding the public, It's really interesting because they have a rule of 5101, which gives them discretionary authority to deny the list securities that pose public interest concerns. This is exactly what I'm talking about, and these rules, they signal that that the NASDAQ, New York, and other exchanges, they're prioritizing long-term operational credibility, okay, as opposed to, hey, my stock went from 50 cents to $3, and all of a sudden I'm the King Creole of it all. Okay, that is what they're trying to get rid of. They want viable companies, companies that are going to succeed, companies that are going to increase shareholder value, companies that are going to do things. Okay, not companies that are just put together with smoke and mirrors to go basically take advantage of investors that run on hype and not on reality. When companies fall out of compliance, they get deficiency notices, and that's the first step. That's only the beginning of this whole process. After that, they have compliance deadlines, and then they have potential hearings under Rule 5810. And then at the end of the day, suspension or delisting if they don't comply, if they don't put corrective measures in place. The market impact is immediate, I'm going to tell you. Because if you have a company that's trading on the NASDAQ, you get knocked down. All of a sudden, you go into an environment where you're on the NASDAQ. Now you're in the OTC markets. Okay, and the OTC markets consist of nanocap. You do have some banks and everything and foreign companies that are on there. And what I mean by banks, like community banks, things like that, because the compliance measures are below what the NASDAQ requires, so it allows them to do what they need to do. But again, you're talking about a different type of market. When you're speaking about the NASDAQ New York and you're talking about global markets, you're talking about liquidity, you're talking about institutions that are jumping in, whether it be bigger institutions, not smaller market makers. And that's a big change. that's going to be a big thing, you know, because moving out to the OTC markets, you know, they may keep your stock alive, they may keep that company alive, but to try to get back and uplist, you know, between the audit financials, governance and everything else, it'll be a long road, okay? And to go and to build up that investor confidence again, it's going to be a difficult thing. And what happens with these companies when they're facing this, and this is where the wheels come off the train, right? They start, you know, focused on reverse stock splits. And these are commonly used when you are under that dollar price. They'll reverse the stock. They'll do a 10 for 1, 24. I've seen deals 500 for 1, which is ridiculous. And who knows what was going on there, right? You know, so what's happening here is that when this transpires, it brings the price up. But it's not really impacting the shareholder, you know, the whole market cap, but it's diluting the shareholders, which is never a good thing to do. You wind up killing, you know, the shareholders involved, the ones that invested, that believed in what was going on. Okay, it may temporarily, you know, restore it to the company to a compliant bid price, but you know what's going to happen. The shorts come out at night and during the day and in the afternoon too, and they're going to do, you know, they're going to do what they need to do to knock it down because you're in a weak environment. You have a, you know, some of these companies have weak revenue models, declining cash reserves, execution risk, and so on and so forth. And what's going to wind up happening, they're going to be in the same position. It may be in a month, it may be in 6 months, but more than likely it happens. And the shareholders, you know, their value gets reduced, is compressed. It's not value creation, it's value, you know, removal. And the dilution factor, because, you know, usually you'll get a reverse stock split, then more stocks will be issued, so you're getting further diluted. And when you do that over and over again, that you know, you're basically telling the world, hey, I'm under financial distress. I, you know, my company is, you know, pretty much hitting a brick wall. We don't know what to do. We're going to hit every branch on the fall down from the tree. Okay, it becomes harder to, you know, for management teams to even believe in the company anymore. Okay, and then they go down another road. They say, okay, well, let's go raise some capital. Let's go put some money in the company and pay our salaries and put some money in our pockets. Well, then you're talking about toxic capital structures. They compound the problem, makes it worse and worse and worse. Okay, especially their convertible notes issued at discounts with warrants attached to them. You know, these type of financial mechanisms, you know, what they do, they this is a debt spiral. Okay, and it creates a situation where they can't get out of it. I've seen good companies, really good people, that get stuck in this because they're linked up with this toxic debt that some, you know, shady investment banker brought to the table because they say, all right, we're going to go do this. We want warrants. We want this. You'll get the money, but you know what? We're basically going to go make, you know, 3, 4, 5 times our money just messing around with the stock, and then you just take that money and hopefully things work out. That's the situation there. Okay, and the warrants, whew, man, they are a persistent ceiling. You know, they are in your face for eternity and a day. All right. You know, you have holders that when they exercise them, they're doing it to strength, not to the weakness, and they're selling it to liquidity. So the more you push it up, the more they're getting out. Okay. And again, hard to get out of the way. I don't care what it is, because if you have warrants, give you an example. You have warrants at a price at a nickel, but meanwhile the stock's trading at two. Okay, what's going to happen? The more the stock moves up, the more things go on, the more liquidity comes into play, and the more problems that are going to occur there. And you'll have companies, and I've seen this too, you'll have companies that'll go out and they'll issue press release after press release, news after news, this deal, that deal, that deal, a whole bunch of hype. But, you know that song, don't believe the hype. You have to believe in reality. You have to go and see what's going on, the reality of things. Okay? And this happens in response to market pressure, you know, when all this stuff starts transpiring, because these microcap companies, they start pivoting aggressively towards these, you know, to other sectors too. And this is the thing, you have a core business. Let's say it's a pharmaceutical business, or you're involved in some industry, and this is where you are building stuff. It blows my mind that a company that is making widgets, or they're doing something in pharma and biotech, that all of a sudden at the drop of a dime, they will go and say, okay, well, now we're an AI company. We're a blockchain company. Oh, we're a crypto native company. Where'd that come from? These investors didn't get involved in your company for you to do these things. And then again, are you proficient in that? Have you been in this area for years? No, and no, and no. This is a feeble attempt to jump into a sector and bring the people on board to do a thing. And again, same situation arises. I'm sorry, it happens. Okay, it doesn't, regardless of the operational alignment, they try to do this. They're hoping that that narrative brings momentum and other investors that are looking for companies like that. And it happens. You can go and look at a lot of companies that are falling out of favor. They're going to start doing this too, you know, and without, you know, real technological integration or measurable revenue impact, these pivots, I mean, come on. Okay, it's a strategy by press release, you know, it's producing short-term excitement but little durable enterprise value, and that is a fact. And a more disciplined evolution is emerging through utility-driven digital asset treasury strategies. I've spoken about this plenty of times. Blockchain is the future of finances and integration and convergence of TradFi and DeFi, and it's a beautiful thing. And they use to strengthen and balance sheet. They're great for doing that. But they have to. They have to be utility driven. Okay, because if you use that to speculate on token appreciation, you're a fool. And if you're doing that as a CEO and this is your plan of action, look, you're not a Michael Saylor. He was an early adopter in doing this stuff. He has this down to his science, but that's his line of business. When a company that's going and producing, you know, Aspen, all of a sudden they're going to be, you know, a blockchain company, AI company, and now they're going to have a digital asset treasury, and we're going to be a digital asset treasury company, and we're going to go and have yield and all this stuff. But the moment that the slippage that goes on, and the moment that the crypto market slide down, what happens? So does your company. You benefit on the way down. You're going to get hurt on the way down. I mean, you benefit on the way up. You're going to get hurt on the way down. All right, and that's the reality of it. Okay, you know, when I speak about this, I'm passionate about it because I believe that a digital asset treasury has to have utility. And if it has utility and it has other things that are going on there to help a company, that is key. Because when structured correctly, digital asset treasuries can function as collateral layers. Listen to me, collateral layers supporting new financial instruments. Such as, and you've heard me speak about this plenty of times, or write about it, post about it, or whatever, digital credit note tokens. They can be geared towards a debt issuance. They provide, they basically create a new class, a new asset class for these companies without diluting shareholders. Can you believe it? That's fantastic. It allows them to go and really, you know, get out of the shadows of what is going on in front of them. And they can even go and use a digital asset treasury to collateralize a project-specific venture token that's tied to a project that has to do with the company. Okay, you know, if you have I'm sticking with biotech because that's what was on my mind today. You know, you have a biotech company that have different projects going on. You can have these tokens tied to that project and go get the public involved or get institutions involved to be a part of what's going on, and it helps to increase the shareholder base. That's a great thing too. You know, institutional participation can increase when treasury activity becomes transparent. When it's verifiable on chain, it reduces counterparty uncertainty and enables real-time auditability. It's basically telling any investor, hey, you know what? This is collateralized. And we believe in this, and this is what we're doing. This is not some dance. We're not dancing on a razor blade hoping that you're going to believe that we're on stable ground. We're doing something transformative. We're doing something to help you, the shareholder, which is helping the company to make things happen. We're looking to change the world. What happened to these to groups like that? What happened to companies like that? They need to understand what is actually, you know, the route they need to go in order to increase shareholder value. Okay, because when you have a DCN, a digital credit note token, and you have an automated hourly yield distribution model that's in place, you have other things that are in place, and it aligns with what you're doing, and it aligns with your narrative for your company, and it's giving you the ability to go work with lenders in a different way, you know, and the innovation that's happening here, you know, is really good, is really interesting. You know, I mean, because when you have a multi-asset, digital asset treasury, and this is, I should have mentioned that earlier, a multi-asset, because you can have various tokens there, you can have tokens that represent, your stock, okay, your lock stock, has to be locked, right? You know, so there's so many different things that can happen. You're talking, you know, creating programmable finance. You're talking about offering structured exposure familiar to institutional capital. You're talking about doing some really, really great things to help your company. And the transparency of blockchain, well, that allows, with the DCNs, you're talking about over 200, you know, on-chain data points that are in the smart contract alone. You know, it allows for a lot of different things to be publicly viewable and validated and everything else. And it helps to provide that transparency, because the smart contracts, they're set to automate compliance workflows. You know, they can align with regulatory expectations, you know, under frameworks like Section 17A, you know, record-keeping principles, improving reconciliation, reporting speed and audit readiness, and so on and so forth. Okay, and now one of the cool things that comes from, you know, DCNs and, you know, certain products that are being rolled out are, you know, the potential for cross-chain bridge development. And when this happens, it will expand the liquidity. It will give more depth to it. Okay, and then, you know, it becomes really interesting, especially when you are talking about having an OTC desk specifically for institutions and specifically for these digital assets, for them to go and, you know, swap peer to peer. You know, that's going to be a very important thing. And I believe that more and more groups are going to be very interested in that, because again, you know, you can't just go and create such an ecosystem out of thin air. Okay, it's something that, you know, needs to be in place. You know, okay, and look, you know, through infrastructure that's being developed by Megahoot Technologies and being deployed via Hootex, both institutional and retail, you know, participants can engage in markets built around transparency, programmability, and verifiable financial logic. Man, you know, you're talking about clarity, not opaque intermediate systems where you don't know what's going on. You don't know who's shorting what. You know, and the thing is with shorts, when you have this type of thing, you know, if you are going and if you tokenize more of your stock, and just to keep everything in line with what you're doing, you know, you can have a true understanding of what's happening. Okay, and prevent naked shorts and that type of thing. But that's a conversation for another show. Okay, now at the end of the day, and I'll leave you with this, the defining question for public companies moving forward is, it's not whether they will want to adopt emerging technologies, it's a matter of when they're going to do it. Okay. And the reality is, if these technologies can create measurable utility, strengthen compliance posture, rebuild shareholder trust, and help the company to achieve their goals through value creation rather than narrative momentum alone, they can do that. These companies can actually pull out better, stronger, and more growth-oriented than ever before. and this is why this type of structure exists. Okay, and you know, the more companies begin to understand this, the more public companies begin to understand this, the more they're going to want to integrate this into what they're doing. And this is not only for public companies, you know, private companies as well, but that's going to be, again, for another show. Anyway, I want to touch on this because I've seen a lot of, you know, funky things going on in the public markets when it comes to, you know, companies on the brink of being delisted. Okay, I just want to address this because I think it's important, because shareholders should have a voice. And a lot of times, you know, they're on bulletin boards, this, that, and all this other stuff. On the show, My Money Never Sleeps, we try to go in and add our 2 cents into the equation, and hopefully it does, you know, have some type of impact out there. All right. Anyway, I want to thank you for tuning in. And until next time, you guys have a fantastic trading day. And we will be back with you with another episode of Money Never Sleeps. Take care.
Initiating shutdown sequence.
You're listening to UCW Radio. In your face.
What is your major malfunction?
So let it be written. So let it be done.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And I thank you.
The views and opinions expressed on Money Never Sleeps Radio are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial advice. The host Louis Balavkev and guests of Money Never Sleeps Radio are not licensed financial advisors, and any investment decisions made based on information presented in this podcast are at the listener's own risk. Listeners are encouraged to consult with a qualified financial advisor or investment professional before making any investment decisions. The podcast hosts and guests do not endorse or recommend any specific investment strategies or products. All investments involve risk, and past performance is not indicative of future results.